Linda said, my name is Kate McGraw, and I work in a program that extends medical care into the homes of frail elders. I'm part of an interdisciplinary team of doctors and nurses and social workers and one chaplain, me, who visit people at home when they're not able to get into their doctor's office anymore. In June of this year, after many years of study and work and training and just life, finally was both ordained at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation at Willamette Falls and also got certified as a professional chaplain. So now I'm taking the summer to sew and read books and garden, and it's lovely. I'm really grateful to be here with you all today. I was drawn to Unitarian Universalism in my late 20s. Now, gosh, almost 30 years ago. Because I loved the conversations that our small Alaskan fellowship had every Sunday. Our hours together reminded me of the best of times that I had spent with my grandmothers, sitting and talking and solving all the problems of the world. Our fellowship in Alaska also considered and analyzed, and we made community together. We even built our own church with our bare hands. Like our Unitarian and Universalist foreparents, we valued clear thinking, scholarly and scientific research, logical argument. All of those are pursuits that require intelligence, intellectual discipline, and clear cognition. Now, nearly 30 years later, I am proud of the heritage of seekers I stand among. We are people who dare to use our gifts to look for what's right and what's wrong in the world and do what we can to make what's wrong better. I'm proud of that for us. And over the years, our people have written thousands and thousands and thousands of pages about what they're thinking. Thinking and writing and talking and analyzing. These stand at the core of our liberal religious tradition, and I am deeply at home here. And I love working with people who have dementia, people who are losing the very cognitive abilities I and we bank on every day. There was a time when that felt like a contradiction. I remember avoiding people with dementia when I first started training as a chaplain. I would go to the floor where I was assigned, the general medical floor at Providence over on Gleason Street, and I would look at my list of patients and I would say, oh gosh, okay, I'm going to see this one and this one and this one. Oh gosh, that one has a dementia diagnosis. I don't know if I want to go in there. I don't know if that person is going to remember what I say, and I don't know what to say anyway, because it's hard to talk to a person who can't answer questions back. A person who isn't logical or can't reflect on their experience. So I rationalized that my time was better spent somewhere else. And I kind of skirted some people that I probably should have gone to see. And then I began to notice how I felt when I worked with people whose cognition was changing. I did a second fellowship year of chaplain training so that I could spend more time with these folks, so that I could learn more about the world from their point of view and learn how to minister with them. This work has challenged me to move into a very different place. In a real way, dementia has shown me that the holy can emerge in our human connections with one another in each moment. Dementia and holy don't seem like they go in the same sentence, though. We are afraid of dementia. Linda hit it right on with the children's reading. We are terrified. There was a poll done in the UK in 2011 that asked people what diseases they were most afraid of, and people were more afraid of dementia than they were of cancer. It terrifies us. As a culture, we agree with Descartes' classic statement of Western philosophy, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. It names the ability to think as the foundation of everything we value about humanness, and it sets us up for a dualism that rips our minds from our bodies and makes us terrified of losing our minds. And there are real reasons for the fear. Dementia is a terminal illness. It's often called brain failure by the doctors that I work with, and I think that makes more sense. It's like kidney failure or liver failure or heart failure. The organ stops working the way it used to, and eventually people die. It's progressive. It relentlessly strips away life as we know it, bit by bit. Literally everything changes. People end up needing help for the most basic of needs. Many of us know this. We love people who have dementia or who have had dementia. We've had people in our lives who have died from dementia. So we have experienced this pain, this what I think of almost as kind of hell for 21st century Americans who like to control and like to be able to think and analyze and talk about stuff. We know what this hell looks like. But working with people who are experiencing the losses of dementia or living in that hell has raised important questions for me. For Alzheimer's dementia, which accounts for about 70% of dementias, the losses of cognition appear in a fairly predictable way over three domains of brain function. The first type of memory, the first type of brain function that's impacted is declarative or episodic memory. And that's the kind of memory that allows us to put words to what we're thinking and feeling. It allows us to solve problems. It allows us to do our checkbooks and read books and talk to friends on the phone and make self-aware, thoughtful statements about what's going on with us. Procedural memory. So once declarative and episodic memory fades, procedural memory is still there. Procedural memory is the kind of memory that is in play when you do something you've done over and over and over again. So like shaking hands or like making a coffee in the morning maybe, or saying familiar prayers if you're a person who comes from a tradition where there are prayers or songs that are really commonly sung. Those are called over-rehearsed behaviors. So if you just think of things that you do over and over and over again, that stays a little bit longer. And emotional memory is the last type of memory to go. It's at work when a man with Alzheimer's doesn't know who his husband is, but he knows he still loves him. Tasks that become difficult early on then are things that have steps that need to be adjusted as you go, like balancing a checkbook or finding your way home in traffic or participating in a study group at church. Eventually, the holier conversation gets hard. People who are experiencing dementia often notice that something isn't right and they develop elaborate ways of trying to keep things going, trying to protect themselves. Like Eileen, and this is not her real name. She wrote notes to herself. And when I met her, she had her handbag sitting on her lap as we talked. And when she had a question, she would open her bag and try to find the answer in her bag. Her bag was full of notes. And that had worked for a time, I'm sure, but at the time when I met her, it didn't work anymore. She just couldn't find the answers in her bag, because there were so many notes. It was sort of a parallel between the bag and what was going on in her head. She was afraid and grieving and really working hard to hide that anything was wrong from me and from herself. Each time changes come to light, like they did for Eileen, there's pain and sadness for the person who is going through it, and for those who love them, it feels like the person they know is slipping away. The body is there, often quite strong and able, and the mind is changing. We who are heirs to the Cartesian worldview, who believe that our minds hold the essence of what it means to be human, we have a hard time with this reality. When we're asked who we are, we're likely to respond with our name or and a description of our work, maybe our political and religious affiliation. Maybe we talk about accomplishments, children we've raised, art we've made. As I was writing this, I was looking around my home and I saw reminders of travel and books I love and even my favorite colors on the walls. All of these are events and trappings and stories that require cognition, clear thinking to be made and enjoyed. And so it is with our loved ones who have dementia when their brains change and they can no longer enjoy the things they've enjoyed, can't do the things they've done, can't analyze a political candidate's foibles with their usual wit and perception. We think they're leaving us. It certainly feels like they are. But that doesn't mean they're gone. Different, definitely. But not gone. When episodic memory fades, procedural memory remains. A person will still be able to do simple interactions they have repeated in the past. But they might begin to isolate from family and friends. They might stay home from church, for example. So as a spiritual community, it's important to pay attention to folks like that who you think are shifting, and you notice that they're not here anymore. One of the ways of caring for a person with dementia is for the people who love them to continue to reach out to them and continue to offer support. Procedural memory retains prayers that have been said over and over, even if the same was many years ago. Lots of us grew up in one religious tradition and now we're Unitarian Universalists. If we were to be struck with dementia, chances are good that if that other religious tradition held frequently repeated prayers, that we would be able to say those prayers. When I meet somebody who I know is, for example, from a Christian tradition, and they can't talk to me, sometimes I do things like start singing a song with them or saying a prayer. And almost always, if I start the 23rd Psalm, people can say it with me. If I say, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want, they're filling in the words. They might not know all of them, but they're filling in the words. It's my hope when I do that, that whether it's their current tradition or a former way of being spiritual or religious, it's my hope that it brings that feeling of connection with what's bigger than us. Just the saying of the words and the being able to go to that place. Often in my work, I make a phone call to a family member before I go visit someone who I know has dementia. That way I can learn a little bit about the person and what kind of spiritual support might be helpful for them. Ask broad questions about a person's life. What's been important to them? What accomplishments would they consider they've made? What have they been proud of? What sadnesses are they carrying? Do they have regrets that might still be with them? Do they have favorite music? Whether it's religious or spiritual or any kind of music, do they have favorite music? Music is a great way that I connect with people, and it doesn't matter what, you know, if it's The Grateful Dead or Amazing Grace. It's a way to connect when words don't work anymore. On one of those calls I listened to, the grieving sister told me that her brother Ken, a young 57-year-old with advanced dementia, isn't there anymore. Barbara is still faithful about visiting her brother, but it's harder and harder to make herself go. She continues to go, though. Even though she's not sure what good it's doing, she visits Ken. This is the power of their bond, of their covenant as brother and sister. Some months ago, when Ken was less sick, Barbara's visits were a beacon for him. Especially when he felt unmoored by his disease, they would sit together, and Barbara would tell Ken stories from his life. As she spoke, he recognized the facts of his life. Yes, our mother's name was Margaret, and our dad was Joe, and we lived in Laurelhurst. There was a porch swing outside where we'd sit and drink cocoa on rainy days. If you watched them, you could see Ken come more into himself, become more grounded in who he was then, and that gave him a context for who he is now. It was as if part of Ken was stored in Barbara's memory. She held it for him, and we do that for one another without thinking about it. We do it for our family members and for our friends and for our people that we go to church with. If you ask my little sister, she can tell you stuff about my teenage years that I'd really rather not remember. But that's part of my story and part of it that she holds, because I really have banished that stuff. At church, we're here for each other over the long term. We know about each other's lives. We celebrate and grieve together. We remember when each other's children were born, when jobs were lost or gained, your parents died. We hold these parts of one another, and like Ken and Barbara, we literally form a community of memory. This points to a really different way of being human than Descartes envisioned. We humans are relational. We are not just supreme minds and bothersome bodies. We are integrated, connected, social beings who exist in an interdependent web of relationship. As part of that relationship, we literally construct and reconstruct one another as we relate together. You can see it clearly in Barbara and Ken's conversation. Barbara holds Ken's memories, and as she tells him about himself, she helps him remember who he is, and that's something he can't do for himself anymore. But I wonder if that's part of why it's hard for her to visit him. He is slipping away, but also the part of Barbara that Ken held is gone. He can't meet her in their shared relationship anymore. Can't generate those embarrassing teenage memories anymore. The part of Barbara that was held in Ken's memory is lost. He can't light up when he sees her. Can't reinforce for her the mutual place that they stand in the world. That shared connection, that shared memory that they both hold, is a spiritual foundation for them. It helps them to know who they are. And what can help for Barbara is gone now. So it just adds to her pain. We are built of our relationships, for sure. And I would suggest that there's even more to us than that. The beauty, the dignity, the honesty of people with dementia has challenged me to move deeper. When I'm with someone who can no longer speak, who might not be noticing whether I'm there or appearing to notice whether I'm there, I can still feel their energy, their presence. There is something more. In his beautiful book, Dementia, Living in the Memories of God, John Swinton ties our human relationality to a religious understanding of humanness. Swinton talks about Genesis 2:7. Can anyone quote Genesis 2:7? I can't either. It's the part of Genesis where God is creating the first human, creating Adam. And God breathes into a handful of dust. The Hebrew term for God's breath is nephesh. And it's understood as the vital principle of life itself. And sometimes it's translated as soul. But Swinton is clear in his book, following Wendell Berry, that nephesh, soul, does not relate to a discrete, immortal dimension of the human person. Rather, it refers to the inbreathing of God's breath into dust, which creates a living entity. So it's a relational act, and it commemorates that act of relationship. And that's what's at the core of us as humans, by Swinton's understanding. We are built relational. He concludes, there is something of God in all human beings and something holy in all encounters between humans. I have experienced this in my work. For some people, there is a beautiful clarity that comes as the layers of cognitive protection are stripped away. It was like that with Dana. In the later stages of her disease, where emotional memory is primary, she would stop in the hallway in front of my desk and just beam at me, just smile, and all you could feel radiating from her was love. Just this amazing, unfathomable love. Her life was complicated, like all of ours are. Her children were raised by their dad, because she left the family when they were small, but she and her daughter mended their relationship. Where there had been difficulty and ambivalence and estrangement, there remained only love. And the last time I saw Dana, she fairly glowed with it. She sang our entire visit in a language all her own. And she, by doing that, invited me into that liminal space, into that space where words are just sounds to sing. And that connection, that sense of presence, was so clear. It was really a beautiful experience for me. And I feel like it gave me glimpses of that nefesh, that uncensored core of all of us. This is what Swinton calls the sacrament of the present moment. He says that to be with one another in the present moment is to allow our souls to touch. Meeting in the present moment is meeting soul to soul, nefesh to nefesh. It is a place where human souls encounter the soul of God. And I agree with him. We UUs come from a long line of people who make the way in the world with our minds. In times past, we hoped for the realization of a vision where humankind would pull ourselves up by our bootstraps, arising, perfected by our reason and hard work. There is power there. That is an important statement, and especially in context, that was such an important statement. But it misses something. The lives of people with dementia teach us that though reasoning well and relating clearly are central characteristics of humanness, there is more to us. We love our minds, and we love the minds of the people in our lives. We enjoy the life of the mind and all that brings, but people with dementia have taught me that if we stay focused there, we miss a lot. What is important to us about human beings, then, if it's not our brains? There's a cue in the process, a clue in the process itself. Emotional memory is the last to fade away. That means our human relationality is present with us until the very end. And that relationality is grounded in how we are made, in that nefesh, that act of creation, where breath, animated dust. So when our grief leads us to say, as Barbara did, that her brother Ken isn't there anymore, we're missing that essential fact. Yes, Ken is drastically changed, but his spiritual center, some people call it soul, remains. At that center, at that point of connection, we are all connected with one another. Of course, many of us don't believe in that Genesis story literally. Maybe the soul is made of God's breath, and maybe it's something else. Some of us aren't comfortable with the term soul at all, but whatever we call it, however we think it came into the world, our interdependent web is woven of something. And that something is present in all of us to the very end. So today, my challenge to myself and to all of you is to find ways to honor those soul connections, those relationships with ourselves, with those close to us in our communities and in our world. Maybe we're called to action, and perhaps we need to simply be in this beautiful and powerful present moment together. In whatever way we do it, May we each find space for our souls to meet as we go through our days. Blessed be. Amen.